Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. This is going to be brilliant today. Before we say a single word, I want to say that if there is a French historian out there who has dedicated many years to researching Napoleon in a sensible way and would like to come on and talk about his life with us, we would welcome you with open arms and give you a platform to discuss him. But we don't have one of those right now. What we have on a Sunday morning, I know I'm hungover, I don't know about Marcus and Zach, we have Zach White, who is a Napoleonic historian. He's our Napoleonic correspondent, basically. Our little Napoleonic god, a Wellingtonian god, because he doesn't want to be a little god without a penis. And we have Marcus Cribb as well, who is one of the managers at Apsley House and therefore has not got a lot of time for Napoleon. And they are going to bring you, on this Sunday morning that we're recording, a Brit's Guide to Napoleon. Guys, are you ready?
Definitely.
Marcus,
you know, this is going to be the death knell of my entire career. And if I ever walk into a room full of Napoleon fans, they're all just going to want to kill me. But yeah, let's do it.
You never wanted to go to France anyway, did you?
Well, he's not going to get his passport now, is he? Zach's a proper academic, whereas I can give guided tours and declare my bias. And it's my house, so my rules. So I just feel sorry for Zach after this.
Excellent. Right. Okay. As we said, anyone who wants to come on and have a sensible chat about Napoleon, we will do it. But this is a Brit's Guide to Napoleon. I can't wait for this. Right, guys, you're going to talk topically going through his life, aren't you? And you're going to rotate between who does the sensible stuff and who basically takes him apart. So let's start with his birth. Marcus, this did not occur in France, did it?
No, the great hero, inverted commas, of France. He's not even French. He gets born the same year that in Corsica, that Corsica is given from Genoa, so Italy, to France. In fact, his parents are early on involved in independence for Corsica from France. So he's brought up amongst all of these and is deeply divided. In fact, in his younger life, he's got this huge family and there's quite a few of them, including Napoleon himself. Who has a dalliance with joining the Royal Navy back in Britain to fight against France. So brilliant. That would have turned our history a bit differently if he'd been at Trafalgar on our side. But he's not even Napoleon Bonaparte. He's Napoleon Bonaparte. He's Italian blooded from minor aristocrats.
But because he doesn't like people associating him with the Italian spelling of his name, because he has a hang-up with this all the way through his life, he speaks with this very kind of thick Italian accent. And in the, just before his Italian campaign in the mid 1790s, he deliberately changes the spelling of his name. So he drops the E off of the end of Napoleon and he drops the U out of the middle of Bonaparte so that it looks more French. And it goes back to his time at military college where he was bullied quite relentlessly for the fact that he was, essentially not typical French. And this whole thing that Marcus mentions about the Corsican move for independence possibly leads to him having sort of daddy issues. We can't be certain because there's so much kind of myth surrounding Napoleon's early life anyway, and there isn't a lot of documentation for it. But what happens is that initially the family had a strongly allegiance to the leader of the Corsican independence movement, a guy called Poli. And Poli had to go into exile after the French kind of asserted their control over Corsica. But Napoleon's dad didn't. He kind of accepted amnesty and sort of ingratiated himself into French society, which is part of the reason why Napoleon's able to go to military college anyway. But he kind of ends up having this issue with his father in sort of betraying the cause of Napoleon, of Corsican independence. And there's an interesting kind of irony to all of this because in 1790, he goes back to Corsica to meet up with Poli, who's been able to go back after the revolution in 89. And they end up having a falling out over the execution of the king. And Napoleon's family has to flee Corsica, never to go back. So he kind of ends up being stabbed in the back by his own hero. So it's an interesting little kind of psychological dynamic going on there right from the start.
Firstly, I suspect there were many reasons he was bullied, and second, one of them being that he was so short, and one of, and also,
oh, but that's a myth.
God, is he not short? Oh,
he's not short. No.
Oh, he wasn't 4'11" and fighty.
Yeah, no. British propaganda is really good at the time, especially when you've got Duke of Wellington, who's very slim, very slight, like tiny by even modern standards, and Napoleon, who's like 5'6", which is like average height is like 5'7". He is just below. But a lot of his marshals are pushing on towards like the 5'11", 6 foot mark. So compared to Wellington, compared to his like peers, he looks quite small. And just like today, where we've got like comics in the press, we got comics back then. In fact, actually, if anything, they were really punchy, as a pun, the Punch magazine. they were really, really good at displaying him as short, fat. In fact, linking in, they called him the Corsican Fiend. And you often have him like displayed with like little devil horns. and people started to believe it. It was actually so far that people, that mothers would be going, you know, eat all your dinner before you go to bed, or Napoleon would come out and get you. He was the ogre. It was a really popular belief that persists to a degree today.
Yeah, it was definitely turned into like a little goblin. It helps that you've got a guy called James Gilray producing caricatures at this time, and Gilray was an absolute genius in how he put together his cartoons. Full of satire, these neat little references, so beautifully detailed. And that really does help to kind of create this image of Napoleon as this tiny little guy. He is actually called the Little Corporal by his soldiers, but it's thought that that might more likely have been a term of endearment.
Yeah, probably.
Because actually, Napoleon was never a corporal. So, you know, the name never kind of works out.
Let's talk about baby Napoleon, little Napoleon, when he actually was like physically little, as in a child, because it turns out he wasn't short, and that makes me very sad. Turns out he was just fractionally taller than me, which makes me really sad. That's like when I met N'Golo Kanté and he was still taller than me and I felt really, really small. Anyway, were there any signs at the École Militaire that he was going to turn out to be an utter psycho?
Yes. There were signs. <we've> got...
Yeah, but not a successful psycho. Like my main thing about his time at the École Militaire is he's not that good. He actually kind of wanted to go and join maybe the French Navy. And that sort of being a bit more elite. He's in a class of 52 officer cadets, students at the École Militaire in France. And he graduates as 42nd. So he's in the bottom 20%. He's not great.
But that's like, Hitler wasn't very great either, which certainly wasn't any good at bloody art. But Hitler was not obviously setting the world alight at school. And you find this a lot with these. Do you think it's compensating?
It is, but not kind of compensating in the way that we might normally discuss on History Hack, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. not that we're at all prone to the smart. We'll get to Napoleon's private parts later,
we'll get there. save that for the end. Keep people listening. He came from quite a big family. And what that meant was that he was constantly competing with his older brothers, which meant he tried to kind of dominate physically over his brothers, constantly fighting, whether it's with his schoolmates, with his brothers, whoever it might be, had to be the best at everything, whether it was climbing a tree or being best at maths, which was the only subject where he seemed to be really good. And that carried through into the École Militaire. But ironically, he was a complete loner. So you have this image of Napoleon, this glorious guy who everybody kind of has this infatuation with. Actually, at school, nobody wanted to know him. Like as we've said already, they was bullied for the fact that he wasn't kind of classically French. He came from minor nobility and had probably had a chip on his shoulder about that. There's this whole thing about him being dedicated to Corsican independence amongst a peer group who were from the nobility of Ancien Régime France. They were completely invested in monarchy and nation. Mm-hmm. And so they had no interest in this kind of Corsican independence thing, and he just seemed like a bit of a weirdo to them, and even his teachers were kind of going, why is he so fixated with Corsican independence? He really needs to kind of get over this.
Napoleon, a bit of a weirdo.
When they're all going out drinking, trying to charm the ladies, he's sitting in his room reading. I think he has a stab at like writing one or two novels, And they say, oh, he reads so much, and he goes, you know, it just goes on and on about him sitting in the room by himself, and everyone else is out enjoying the highlights of, you know, Parisian life and really living it up large. He doesn't. And so socially, very strange. You can kind of imagine, by modern standards, that one kid in the corner doodling in their notebook in class.
It's probably us, to be honest.
Yeah, this is exactly what I was thinking. I mean, I've got no issue with him being a bookworm. But the thing about Napoleon is everybody kind of talks about his military prowess and his ability. But because he'd spent so much time reading, he basically steals loads of other people's ideas and then makes them work for himself. And so everybody talks about Napoleon's genius. His genius essentially is to take other people's concepts and make them work.
His genius is plagiarism.
Basically, yeah. He makes a career out of it. I mean, really, people should kind of take note.
I do have to ask, though, Marcus, he did venture out occasionally. Prostitutes,
yeah. He's not doing very well with women. So he tries to go out. He's, by this point, he's pretty penniless as well. His dad's passed away and not left him any money. But he decides he's going to try to, you know, get his leg over for the first time. He's living in Paris. And he basically fails. He fails to pay a woman for sex.
If you fail to get laid in Paris by money in your pocket, yeah. Ouch.
I mean, we talk about socially awkward. He's literally going out with a bag of money and then bottling
still
it.
Still coming back a virgin.
Or just bumbling a bit so much that he doesn't really manage it.
Oh, dear. Right, Zach, Toulon.
Toulon, right. Toulon's the first time that Napoleon kind of gets to make a name for himself. It comes in the wake of his family having to flee Corsica. So by this point, Napoleon's kind of given up on the whole Corsican independence thing, and he's started to get sort of emotionally and kind of career focused about spending his time in the French army. And the city of Toulon, there's a change of government and there's a revolt. There's a royalist revolt, and Toulon is one of the towns that declares for the royalists. To try and restore the French monarch to the throne. And they get support from the Royal Navy, a fleet under Hood comes in and supplies them and helps to kind of organise the defence. And the French government kind of looks at this and quite clearly needs to retake the city, partly because a big chunk of the French Mediterranean fleet is based in Toulon. And so Napoleon turns up. And this is one of those times where he actually does really well for himself, and it's literally just him. It does help that he has the ear of some key people in the government, and he's able to constantly kind of badger them and push for, basically essentially saying his superiors are incompetent and people need to follow his plan because his plan is the best. In fairness, he has got this really dynamic plan, and I think if he'd had the support of his superiors, particularly the general commanding in the region, he would have... His plan probably could have worked, but it kind of gets sabotaged along the way because his superior doesn't like the fact that he's got this little major by this point. He's been made chef de bataille, which is the equivalent
of the artillery. He's managed to make it
artillery. Because Napoleon qualifies as an artilleryman. That's always his focus and his preoccupation the whole way through.
It's the only thing I can't say against him.
Yeah. And so... He does a really good job of kind of reorganizing the artillery, bringing loads of pieces together. At one point, he's injured, leading an attack on a fort. He ends up with a British bayonet stuck through his thigh. At one point, there's talk about maybe they need to amputate, but that never happens. I mean, imagine how different history would have been if that had been the case. But yeah, I mean, I haven't really got any issues with his time at Toulon. It's kind of Napoleon working really hard, doing what he does best, kind of organizing things, injecting some energy, coming up with a good plan and making it work. And he's eventually able to position artillery in such a way that the British are forced out of the perimeter defences that they've built around the Bay of Toulon and is then able to fire on the British fleet. And as soon as that happens, the British obviously pull out. They can't risk their warships. And they haven't kind of prepared for this eventuality. There haven't been sufficiently well-laid plans to burn the French fleet. And so the French are able to, in effect, recoup most of their Mediterranean fleet off the back of what Napoleon does. And it's really important in terms of him receiving promotion. Quite quickly, he becomes Brigadier General off the back of that, but then turns down a posting to the Vendée to put down more royalist uprisings because, quote, there isn't enough glory in it for him, which gives you a flavour of the guy. He's always chasing something that's going to sort of further his name.
Oh, dear.
You say nothing gets too long. The day after it's captured, 200 collaborators are shot with no trial.
Is that just Napoleon, though, in fairness?
That's not just Napoleon, but he's now taken over command and he's not exactly stopping this. And these aren't
that's true.
Killings.
I always think there is now mass
executions in the streets.
I mean, there are other points when slaughtering civilians is definitely his thing.
Oh, yeah.
I think we're coming to those, aren't we? Marcus has got that on his list. Marcus, do you have to give him credit for the bridge at Arcole?
Not as much as he's given.
basically, no, I do not.
dismiss. So Arcole's really important for the what I always term the cult Napoleon. I think that's fair, Zach. He's really successful in building up himself. Or not discouraging it. And it still persists today. There is a Bonapartist political movement. There are people who would genuinely have his picture above their bed or in their study. It's quite big in ways that we don't see of other people.
It's worse than that, though. I mean, I've seen people kissing symbols of Napoleon, whether that's busts of him or things like French imperial flags from this period. Later on, we'll talk about a guy who Marcus and I dealt with on Facebook who refused to listen to any sense of reason whatsoever. But that relates to Waterloo and Borodino. So we'll save that for you.
I was going to say, you must get a lot of it on. There must be a fair amount of loons on social media.
It takes up too much time.
And if you think of Trump's ultra loyalist fan base, the politics doesn't correlate. And we'll get to that as well later. So I'm not saying Napoleon was Trump at all. But if you think about the utter kind of blind belief in everything that comes out of Trump's mouth that some of his supporters have, you can get the exact mirror image of that when it comes to Napoleon. And we've had people, because Marcus and I spend a lot of time trying to inject kind of a subtle bit of nuance into these.
A lot more subtle than what we're doing right now.
Yeah. And people just won't have it. And they'll just kind of blindly scream Napoleon's own propaganda without actually questioning it. And that's really the problem.
And that's actually Arcole. That's exactly it. So at Arcole, he basically is leading a battle. And it's all based around this bridge. And there is a beautiful painting of this young Napoleon with long brown hair, glittering blue eyes, with a tricolour flag in one hand and a sword in the other, charging up this bridge. And then there's always close-ups paintings of him looking like some sort of Prince Charming with the
purple. He looks great.
Waft. He looks stunning. Like, I'm trying to think, it's more of a Hugh Grant kind of figure.
Is it a lie?
Absolute lie. So what he does is he grabs the flag. He runs forwards and then he sees that anyone who's going onto the bridge is getting shot. So he stands on this little mound just to the side, plants the flag there and starts waving everyone forwards. In fact, it draws so much attention from the far side that there's a general stood at the front waving that people are getting shot left, right and centre, that one of his men basically grabs him, effectively bundles him down the slope. He stands up all covered in mud and they push him back down again, going, just stay out of the way. And he's just absolutely filthy, bit like dejected. And he's nowhere near actually staying foot on the bridge. But all the paintings have him on the bridge. And certainly paintings that were like commissioned whilst he was emperor. And he's never going, actually, wasn't there? No, he's quite happy with having his image of him being right at the front, sword in hand, ready to fight the enemy.
But he nearly never gets there. On a few levels. So he has this thing I mentioned earlier about the brigadier generalship. Mm. And him turning down that post into the Vendée. He's then put on the sort of chief of staff for Paris. And he's basically unemployed. He doesn't really have a job. He's kind of shot his opportunity, really, to kind of keep clawing his way up the career ladder. And what happens is there's an uprising against the government. And the Napoleon kind of ends up being the man of the moment. He basically gathers together a whole load of artillery. He's given command of the Paris garrison as the government, key officials in government start to realise what's happening. And he is basically told, look, defend the government, do what it takes. So his solution is to basically get all the artillery that he can possibly find, ride it through the streets of Paris at breakneck speed, nearly running people over in the process.
Women and children flying.
Genuine, yeah, but it gets worse than this.
Oh, yeah.
And he positions it, covering key approaches to the main government buildings. And a crowd gathers, which consists of protesters of various kinds, including women and children. And he gives the order to fire. It's known as the whiff of grape shot. And basically these civilian protesters, admittedly some of them were probably armed, are basically mown down. Nobody knows the number of casualties. Napoleon deliberately doesn't kind of bother to count the casualties. He doesn't want that kind of staining the success of what he's done. And it's because of his success in that that he becomes this kind of figure. He's on sort of the tip of everybody's tongue, becomes a household name. That's what I'm looking for. And it's off of that that he actually gets the posting at Italy, because before that point, he's been putting all of these plans together and nobody's interested in his plans for Italy.
He's very good with artillery. He's known to personally sight guns later in his career, and it wouldn't be too much of a stretch to say he's doing it in the streets of Paris. And he's often thought of as being this continuation of the revolution. He's leading the liberalism, the reforms for the people. And then he turns around and shoots them with canister shot, which is like giant shotguns, hundreds of like giant shotguns, point blank against women and children. Some armed people too, definitely. There's an angry mob, but there's definitely unarmed civilians mixed in with that.
Speaking of, let's give this one to Marcus because he's going to love this. Egypt, massacres, and a Jesus complex.
Yeah, that sounds like a good title for a book, doesn't it?
sounds like a Channel 5 documentary, but let's
be that would be my probably my biography of Napoleon. So he goes off to Egypt. He does a fantastic campaign. Got to give him the credit for the Battle of the Pyramids, fighting against the Mamluks, kind of an Ottoman Empire offshoot.
But doesn't that mainly consist of forming square and letting the Mamluks come to them?
Because they do this thing
of just charging at squares.
They've got fantastic cavalry with camels. So they form square, which is like a four-sided, four-rank deep, fixed bayonets. And
just wait for them to commit suicide.
And they're basically charging you. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. You just can't miss. Mm. It's a fantastic tactic. It works. Yeah. It's not difficult. But
it's why you do it, isn't it?
Wellington does the same thing at Waterloo when the French charge in. So
when Ney does it, it does work. Got to give him some credit for that one. And then he ends up after capturing city of Jaffa after a long siege. And this is where Zach was saying about the massacres. He waits for quite a while and then he executes like all the like Ottoman prisoners he's got. Estimates range anywhere between 1,000 and 5,000, but safely to say like 2,000 to 3,000 prisoners. And we're not talking prisoners like straight after a battle. We're not talking like, you know, they're uprising in jail. Like they're just sat in a prison and he effectively doesn't want to feed them anymore, doesn't want to look after them, and he just kills them all.
Yeah, there are two sides to that, which is one is that he finds out that a lot of these prisoners were soldiers that he had released on the condition that they wouldn't fight the French again. And that's kind of slightly naive thing, I think, to expect that if you release these soldiers that they're never going to fight your nation again.
Especially when you're in their homeland.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, you can turn around and say, okay, look, but they broke their word. This was a condition, forfeited their lives in the process. But what people don't bother to mention, if they are pro-Napoleon, is that in amongst these, it's probably about 2,000 to 3,000, as Marcus says, are, again, women and children who end up being shot as well. And the argument goes, well, look, he couldn't have fed them all. And he didn't have the men to guard them as prisoners. And so he effectively had a choice of abandon his campaign and leave these people alive or kill them and be able to carry on with what he's doing. But whichever way you spin it, you can't justify killing women and children, in my opinion.
Mm. Not even in the military era of the time. I don't think it's justifiable. It wouldn't have been accepted under the general codes of war. And so he kills them all, effectively. I think they start shooting and then they get bored of reloading. And so they fix bayonets and start stabbing away. And you can imagine it would have been terrible scenes. Then he's kind of gets some sort of karma for it, but not personally. His army in the city suffered from a traditional biblical plague and boils and pestilence kind of plague. And this is where the Jesus complex comes in. He starts walking through, they're like put in like hospital quarters, and he starts walking through them and like poking, touching their boils, thinking it would make them feel better, that their generals seem to not fear it. And I'm thinking, this is less like Diana going to, you know, shake hands with an AIDS victim, the more somebody who's starting to believe he actually might have the power of the touch. Mm. It gets very strange in walking amongst the plague victims.
It starts to have that air of kind of like the king curing scrofula by touching it, doesn't it? That kind of tradition of great people having this unique magical ability.
If I plant my hand upon your head, you're cured.
Exactly. And it ties in quite neatly with him starting to think about going back to France to basically take control of the government in a coup. And so what he then...
Funny you should say that, because he leaves his entire army starving, dying of plague. They've already been defeated at Battle of the Nile. Our friend Nelson's kind of come in and destroyed his navy, so he can't win the campaign. But
I don't blame him for that, though.
Don't blame him for leaving all of his men to die?
No, I don't blame him for the Nile. I blame him for...
Oh, okay, yeah.
I blame him for abandoning the army.
Marcus was ready to get fighty then.
I was like, I'm never going to serve an army
through the camera. But... No, I don't blame him for the Nile, because I think the credit for that goes to Nelson. The French fleet was kind of anchored in Abukir Bay in what you'd kind of expect. And Nelson takes a bit of a gamble and he kind of gets his fleet behind the anchorage point, which was risky because you've got the French fleet, you've got a small strip of water, and then you've got the shallows, so his fleet could have run aground. So that was what I use a technical term for this, a ballsy move. By Nelson there. So I don't blame
if you're going to give credit to anyone, like Nelson is a risky strategist, a risky admiral, and Napoleon doesn't really know how to use his fleets very well. We see that time and time again.
And that's why the Egypt thing goes wrong, because with that fleet crushed, he can't get resupplies, he can't get reinforcements. There's nothing to protect those convoys coming in. Which is part of the reason why he does this move up into the Middle East. But the whole strategy for the Egypt campaign is kind of typically Napoleon, really ambitious, but nobody sort of quite seems to have dotted all the I's and crossed the T's.
I mean, we say Egypt, he's pushing into like modern day Jordan and all the way up the coast.
Jaffa's Israel, isn't it?
Yeah.
Plan beyond that was potentially, can we use Egypt as a base to strike into India? Now, if you look at a map, that's kind of Alexander the Great style thinking. And again, we kind of come back to that thing of kind of great man thinking and kind of being a big fan of people like Caesar, who we've got evidence of him kind of idolizing from very early on. Comes back to this whole kind of messiah complex of he can do anything and nobody can stop him.
Caesar complex, that's going to end well, isn't it? Right, okay, you've mentioned the coup. What happens?
Yeah, so he comes back, he's noticing again, he's left his men. Sometimes take years to get home if they survive.
Go back and get them, they just have to figure it out themselves.
Get defeated by the British in the end.
Yeah, they fight on a bit. Britain goes over and sends quite a small expeditionary force. And they fight, again, actually some quite good battles, but we'll get into that another time. Mm. And most of them get left, very few ships left that come back and get them. And some of them do take, if they survive, take a long time to get back. And so Napoleon kind of comes back himself and he rewrites the immediate history, going, yeah, that was a really good trip to Egypt. That went really well. My troops out there, like, having a little colony, little holiday, you know, it's just like the south coast of Spain. Having
saw the sites, saw the
pyramids. Got the Rosetta Stone.
Yeah, brought back the Rosetta Stone.
Does he not get blamed for shooting the nose off the Sphinx? It's not true, is it? It's quite funny.
He does go on a guided tour into a pyramid and gets lost, and apparently comes out really scared. there are rumours like, you know, it's a bit like Tomb Raider. He sees some stuff in there.
See, I'm quite jealous of that, because these days you can't go in the pyramids. No. So...
You can go in the main one. You basically have to, but it's like, when we went, it was like 50 degrees inside. It's not until you get to the chamber at the top that actually, for some reason, it's very cool. But it's if you're claustrophobic, that's not a fun experience. And that was just going straight up and straight down. I think if you started wandering around tunnels and stuff and got lost, that would be quite...
Yeah, with just the flame torch, you're talking here. He
that's like mummy territory.
Very
where Amidjalili gets eaten by the scarabs.
I can imagine that, yeah, Napoleon would run away and leave Emma Jalili to die from scarabs.
Oh, hell yeah.
great, great Persian actor. destructive figure, Emma Jalili. Brilliant.
He is brilliant. And he's Chelsea as well. We love him. Anyway, we were talking about the coup. So he's buggered off home.
So he's buggered off home. He's talking about mummies and holidays in Egypt. And he's spun it all as a great success. And basically, he then instigates a military coup. This is not like a continuation of democracy in any sense. There's two chambers, a bit like, you know, your Senate and your representatives, or your commons and your lords. And he forces his way in with some military officers, leaving his guards outside. Very firm here. His army, his guards are on the doorstep. And he goes into one and is like, I'm here. I've heard that you want a new leader. Here I am. And they go, we're in the middle of a debate. Can you, like, go away? So he goes off. And he tries to make some speech about, I think this is where he throws in some Caesar references and this following of the revolutionary, and there's dangers abroad. And they're going, well, this is a really strange scene, because at this point, the representatives, the senators, are actually wearing like Roman togas, robes. And he's there in full military uniform with a sword, saying that he's there to save them. And it's just huge confusion. He gives this speech. It's not very good. One of his brothers is there. They try to give a speech to save it. And then they all accuse him of starting a military dictatorship, which, lo and behold, is exactly what's about to happen.
Oh, I love the French. They're bonkers. Zach, do you want to mitigate that at all? Or is that pretty much fair?
It is kind of fair. I mean, it's almost worse. I think Marcus is being quite kind about Napoleon's speech. He screws the whole thing up. He kind of has this sort of mini nervous breakdown in the middle of it all. And genuinely can't get his words out. He just kind of starts talking incoherently. And everybody's kind of going, what the hell are you chatting about? And he has to go and have a lie down whilst his brother, as Marcus says, sort of tries to salvage the situation with a much better speech, in fairness. But the one thing I would say is that it's not just Napoleon on his own. He is encouraged by his former kind of, oh, what's the word? Marcus, we're going to have to edit this. Paul Barras, Napoleon's his protege. So he's encouraged by a few people, including his kind of former mentor, a guy called Barras, who's one of the leading people in the government. And they've looked at the way in which the government has completely mishandled the conflict. Because you have to bear in mind that throughout all of this period, France is at war. It's not just Napoleon who's fighting France's campaigns. And initially, there were a lot of really important gains in Italy, thanks to Napoleon. He gets this kind of nickname, the Italian whirlwind. That's how he is trusted with the Italian campaign. But it's also seen as a nice opportunity to get this really famous, really popular kind of French hero out of the way. Go send him to Egypt, where he can't make trouble for us, and kind of be an opponent to us and topple the government. So clearly that didn't work out very well. But during the time that Napoleon's out in Egypt, the French have lost their gains in Italy, they've lost their gains in Germany, and it looks like the government is sort of just a little bit incompetent. And that's why he has this kind of sense of, I can do so much better, and why he comes in and sets up this consulate system where you've got three consuls, and he surprisingly makes himself the most important of those.
Does he also not completely reduce the impact of the other two?
Yes, so it's meant to be three, and they're meant to rotate every year, first consul, second consul, third consul. Yeah, we never get to the second and third. I mean, they still exist.
It just rotates from Napoleon to Napoleon.
One of them actually does the bulk of the work for Napoleon, for the code Napoleon. But he's first consul, and the first year comes and goes, and he's still first consul. And then later on down the line, he's first consul for life. It's not to sound like Caesar here, anyone.
Just shades of Oliver Cromwell here, isn't there?
Shades of Oliver Cromwell mixed in with a Caesar complex.
And a Jesus complex.
Wow. And we've got all of that in a Corsican general. It's quite interesting.
This can only end well. Right, Marengo. Again, he's portrayed, isn't he, as going across on a magnificent white horse,
so
like
a
demigod.
Painting. If you go to, I think it's in the Louvre. If you go into this, you've got him on a white stallion.
Oh, it's that one. Zach's holding it up. You will see
rearing this. And on his feet, it's got it's got the stones of Alexander, and
it looks like a heavy metal album cover.
Yeah, flowing hair again, the robes rippling back in a heavy. You'd need like a proper wind machine for this. It'd be like a L'Oreal.
You'd need one of those 40 grand Beyonce ones that Aerosmith.
Yeah, that's the one. That's exactly
Steven
what
Tyler
he's
said on stage that he had envy, so he went and bought one as well, so he could.
Maybe he's born with it. Maybe it's Bonaparte kind of thing going on.
What's the issue with this painting, Marcus?
Absolute bollocks.
Is he on a donkey?
He's on a donkey. Maybe a nag. And he's going, his robe is going to be flowing out behind him. He's going to have it's cold. He's going to have it tucked up all around himself. And there is a realistic painting of this. And he's like downtrodden, the rain pulling his hat down, his coat up. It's going to be a bit more of a scene out of The Hobbit where they're all like the mountains, like trying to kill them. That's what it really looks like across the Alps.
Can we credit him with the growth of the French Empire? What are the pros and cons of him being in charge? I'm keen to hear about the Vatican at some point.
The thing that Napoleon really can do, and the thing that nobody can take away from him, is that he's very good at warfare. And the empire is built, really. And the problem, ultimately, for the empire is that it's built on Napoleon. And him having this kind of, hey, let's see what happens, opportunistic approach. So with the crossing of the Alps that leads to the Marengo campaign, his purpose there is to recapture what he'd captured, first of all, in the 1790s in Italy and re-establish what eventually becomes the kingdom of Sicily with, surprise, surprise, guess who is his head? Napoleon. There are points when Napoleon's ability on the battlefield kind of deserts him. The Russian campaign, which we'll get to in a minute, is the obvious example. But Napoleon is very good at moving large numbers of men very, very rapidly in such a way that they can come together at vital moments and encircle and hammer his enemy. And it's only with time that he fights. There's an irony in this as well, actually. It's only in time that, because he fights his enemies so often and is always pursuing this kind of overwhelming victory over his enemies and extracting extortionate peace terms off the back of it, that he's able to build his empire. But then over time, they learn his tactics. They learn to fight like Napoleon. And the irony comes in the fact that he himself is alleged to have said that you shouldn't fight your enemy too often because they learn your way of making war. And that's
massive parallels with Jose Mourinho here. Came sweeping in with all these new tactics in 2004, 2005. Everybody learned how to deal with them. He didn't evolve, and now he's a raving loon. He is a reincarnation of Napoleon.
Okay, I was just going to say, even like Zach and I, we say Napoleon like anti-Napoleon, but actually we're just trying to balance out the absolute like cult bullshit. But even we can't say he was a bad general. He was a good general. He was very good. He does have the advantage of like introducing mass military conscription, which is hugely unpopular, but he is a good general.
Somebody else's idea though, conscription, levying en masse, way before his time.
Levying en masse. He is also a loon that tries to kidnap the Pope, right?
It does kidnap the Pope.
really?
Like, no, but we're not just talking like, oh, we're going to invite her for dinner and put a pistol on the table. He invades the Vatican, like full-blown military invasion into the Vatican, pulling the Pope out by his short curlies and putting him into basically house arrest so he can do whatever he wants. Pope's got a lot of power. He's got a lot of power over Italy and... as much as the revolution's tried to get rid of religion in France, Catholics, you know, are still going to be loyal to somebody other than Napoleon. So they're listening to the Pope for moral guidance and also some legal guidance. You know, Catholicism's going to follow your code on who do you give your money to and your marriages and some of the civil context. It's a really difficult relationship for Napoleon, and he tries to negotiate for a while. And the Pope's mostly interested with sitting in, the Papal States are a bit bigger than the Vatican. They're a small kind of like principality in the centre of Italy. But he goes on a full-blown war and invades the Vatican.
Because this is at the point, Italy's not a country yet, is it? It's not unified. So no, the Vatican not is unified. Its own state.
Yeah, it's a fully fledged country.
How does this end for him?
Overall, badly. He has to wait quite a while and then release the Pope. Promises and basically tries to make the Pope promise that he's going to not meddle in France. He has to give some concessions to the Catholic Church and set it back up, because funnily enough, people want their churches back, and having the church under full control of one man, Henry VIII, anyone?
Well, this is the thing. We're now rolling Caesar into Jose Mourinho into Henry
Oliver
VIII,
Cromwell,
into
Henry
VIII. Oliver Cromwell, yeah. These just gets better and better, doesn't it?
Great parallels, but I don't think they're completely untrue. I mean, during this all, depending on your religious bent, Napoleon is excommunicated from the Catholic Church. Yeah, it's not really a surprise. He's kidnapping the Pope. But he is excommunicated. And this is where some of the cartoons we talked about earlier come really big. They were calling him like a little fiend, a Corsican fiend. This is where they start calling him the devil, the Antichrist. These cartoons take on a whole new level where he's got like a forked tail. He's eating babies on a trident. Even Britain, which obviously a Protestant country, is going, oh, the Pope doesn't like Napoleon. We can take this for some political propaganda. And it just plays straight into our hands.
It's something that had bubbled for a long time, though, hadn't it? Because, I mean, if you think about when he becomes emperor, he invites the Pope, and the Pope has to stand there and not crown Napoleon, because Napoleon decides that the only person who can crown Napoleon is Napoleon. So we're back to that whole kind of messiah complex all over again. And the Pope is literally just an onlooker, kind of there to sort of bless and add credence to this whole ceremony, where Napoleon basically reinstalls himself as the emperor of, in effect, the king, except he calls himself emperor. But he tries to establish this hereditary monarchy, in effect, in a different name.
Oh, the Pope's completely an onlooker. He's got the crown. We're talking about he's going from first consul to life to emperor. He takes the crown, puts it on his own head. It's not having a Pope put it on his head. He then takes the crown off the cushion and puts it on Josephine, his wife's head. He does the crowning ceremony, completely bypassing the Pope.
Just briefly tell me, did Josephine ever rein him in, or does she support?
She wasn't interested.
Really?
He was not besotted with Josephine very, very early on. So it's an interesting relationship, because we talked about Napoleon's mentor earlier on, a guy called Barras. Now, Josephine had previously been one of his mistresses. And so, in effect, it's thought that Napoleon's kind of encouraged to marry Josephine in order to kind of remove his mentor's mistress from creating some kind of awkward situation. So a case of kind of getting somebody else's seconds, if you like. Now, Josephine had a string of lovers. She had a couple of kids by that point. She'd been married before. I can't remember what happened to her previous husband. Did he get executed during the revolution?
He was executed, guillotined, full blown, and she was in prison awaiting execution.
The thing about French revolutionary politics is that everything changes on a dime. And so you get things, different governments constantly coming in and going out. So she ends up not being executed, obviously. She marries Napoleon, isn't particularly interested. For a long time, she refuses to marry him. They marry shortly before he goes off to fight the first Italian campaign in the mid-1790s. And within weeks, she's carrying on with the lovers that she had before she married and met Napoleon. She's got no interest. It's a marriage of convenience.
One thing that I find very strange about Josephine is that's not her name. That's the name that Napoleon gives her.
Because it sounds very French.
Bit controlling. Yeah, she's Marie-Joseph Rose, Tasha.
She's known as Rose, actually. That's
so
the name
she's known as Rose. She's got,
as in an English Rose.
She's known as Rose, but her first name's Marie. Her middle name is Joseph, actually. And Napoleon kind of picks on that and says, oh, you know, my little Josephine. And he starts to play that up. And I just find it a bit controlling, like a bit strange that he's changing her name from her first name or her given username, Rose, and choosing another one. It's almost like rebranding her, possessing her.
Yeah, but Marcus, we're talking about the guy who rewrites his own name, builds the largest empire France has ever seen, controls it all through an authoritarian dictatorship and military
yeah,
police.
Yeah, maybe his sexism like pales into insignificance.
Yeah, but the misogyny is kind of an afterthought.
This kind of seems out of character from what we know about the guy, you know?
Guys, you've already mentioned military reforms with the conscription. He's not an innovator, is he?
No. So the two things that people bang on about are massed batteries. That's taken from a manual that he read during his time learning his trade at military school. And actually, there's no big difference in the way that in the ratio of artillery to men. So it's often said that Napoleon loved to have as many guns as he possibly could. Actually, he's averaging out about 3 guns to every 1,000 men, which is still more than the British.
And what does he call his guns, if this is not going to get weird?
Yeah, his big girls.
His big girls, or his beautiful daughters. He like kind of almost like sexualizes his
face.
God, there is nothing about this man that isn't massively creepy. What about the Code Napoleon, which I'm not surprised he names it after himself.
Well, but the Code Napoleon.
It after himself, he's got
his greatest achievement ever of reforming all of the things, apparently working tirelessly through the night writing this new document.
Someone else wrote it, right? You're going to tell me?
Yeah, of course he didn't write it. He barely supervised it. It was actually, so we were saying earlier, it was actually the second consul who, you know, doesn't do a lot of consuling because it's Jean-Jacques Regis de Combres. I hope I pronounced that right. He's the second consul and he basically leads like a project team. He gets a team of half a dozen lawyers and they sit down. And don't get me wrong, French law at this time needs reforming. It's like changes from the north to the south. It changes by county. The law within Paris is different to the laws of the suburbs of Paris. And it massively is biased towards A, the aristocracy still, and B, the church. So it needs reforming. But Napoleon kind of goes, look, we need to reform it. Gives it to one man to do. He works tirelessly on it with a small team and completely like rips everything up and starts again. Napoleon comes in with some very strange suggestions. Like if you're doing inheritance on its twins, it's very complicated. And Napoleon comes in with going, yeah, well, the second one out is obviously the first one in. So the second twin's older than the first. And he comes up with some very strange, what I would almost call like a bit backward thinking suggestions, but doesn't write it.
Yeah, I mean, it's
like put pen to paper.
It's important that you have, like you said already, that we do give the credit for the fact that French law needed a rewrite at this point.
Yeah.
And this is something
well, they've just lopped the heads off of most people, haven't they? So,
well, this is why
I mean, that does mess up your legal system.
Yeah.
There has been a kind of anarchy, if you like, in France for a good chunk of the revolution. And if Napoleon provides one thing, it's a period-ish of stability. Admittedly, it's stability through war, but it is a kind of stability and a longevity that could have been much longer, ironically, if he'd been willing to kind of compromise and kind of scale back some of his demands when it came to peace negotiations and so on. But there are some significant drawbacks for women that should be acknowledged.
I was going
and
to
really
ask
are.
How do women and slaves fare at this time? Because slavery is obviously a hot topic, isn't it?
Well, the French Revolution bans... It's banned during the French Revolution, slavery. Mm-hmm. Napoleon brings it back in.
And women, he doesn't just bring it back in later on, enforces it in Haiti.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. If people want to look up Toussaint L'Ouverture, the
Haitian
very
Revolution,
famous,
which is the anniversary of this year.
There's a whole podcast to be done there.
And if we're talking on this, also... They then start massacring the slaves after they recapture them. So, I mean, it's terrible. Absolutely terrible. Men, women, children again, unarmed, who are fighting for their own freedom, massacred because Napoleon wants to reintroduce slavery because he's running short of money because of all the conscription and all the wars.
And when it comes to women's rights, you've got a situation where women gain quite a lot out of the French Revolution because you've got these kind of ideas going around of to what extent can women be equal and... No, let's be clear, nobody's suggesting complete equality, nobody's suggesting universal female suffrage or anything. We're not going that kind of egalitarian. But when Napoleon's code comes in, it basically makes women subservient to a patriarchal society where the husband or the father has complete control over the woman and all of her belongings. I really wish you could see what Alex is doing right now.
There's a hand gesture going on.
So, although the Code Napoleon does have a longevity and it is exported around the world because it is a comprehensive set of, in many cases, quite well thought through, well laid out laws. And that is a significance that even if you're quite anti-Napoleon, people tend to turn around and say, look, Code Napoleon lasts, and it lasts for a reason, because it was needed. Mm. But as Marcus has said, the extent to which it all comes out of his brain is debatable, and nobody who's a big fan of Napoleon ever wants to acknowledge the drawbacks, of which there are significant ones.
Let's go.
When you say exports, like export via bayonets, let's be fair here.
I wasn't
into like places like Spain.
Yeah, that's
because he conquers the country.
Yeah,
but it's always being held up as going to all these other nations. But if you conquer them, remove their legal system, you've got to replace it with something else. So
yeah, there is that. But I was thinking more kind of beyond Europe. So I've been speaking to people lately who've been working on things like South American constitutions, and they draw quite heavily on the Napoleonic Code, so it has a life beyond Napoleon.
Yeah, there were parallel revolutions going on, and it was very handy because it was an all one handy document. Get to it. It's very, very well produced by Jean-Jacques. I think we're going to give him some more credit in history.
Right. Okay. We are now at the sharp bit, aren't we? Portugal and Spain. Tell me about that first.
Right. Napoleon. You know how he said he kidnapped the Pope. Guess what he does? He basically kidnaps the Spanish monarchy. It's a little bit more complex than that. So let me give the context.
But he does.
Yeah, basically this is what happens. He takes them hostage and tells them to kind of give up the Spanish throne. But we'll get there. There's, throughout this period, apart from a 18-month span called the Peace of Amiens, Britain and France are almost constantly at war with one another. And it takes its toll on both countries, militarily, but also financially. The thing that Britain is able to do is bankroll other nations to fight Napoleon. So it basically hires other nations' armies, in effect, gives them these vast subsidies, and sort of hires them as kind of these massive mercenary forces by forming a series of coalitions against Napoleon. Unsurprisingly, Napoleon gets quite hacked off with this. Now, some people say, oh, it's always the British who are kind of causing these wars. That's not true. There are plenty of instances when Napoleon gives as good as he gets, which isn't often acknowledged. And on many instances where other nations are encouraged to join a coalition, it's quite often because they've got lasting grievances from the last time he beat them, where he extracted excessive peace terms. And so in a way, he kind of contributes to this endless self-fulfilling cycle of war. But by 1807, he's reached what is effectively the height of his power. People think that the time when he's in Moscow, 1812, is the height of his power. It's not. By that point, it's all falling apart at the seams. 1807, there's a treaty...
Literally, with frostbitten bits coming off. Yeah. But 1807, he's rocking it.
Yeah. He's just signed the Treaty of Tilsit with the Russians, and he sets out what he calls the Continental System, which is basically this idea that nobody in Europe is allowed to trade with Britain. And it's a great concept, except that other nations aren't particularly keen. So it goes back to that podcast of the day about buying British.
Yeah.
It's a great system if you assume that every other nation in Europe is quite happy to have their economic policy dictated by one guy. But surprise, surprise, they're not. And so it starts with Portugal, because he issues this ultimatum to the Portuguese saying you're going to close all of your ports to British trade, which is a massive problem for Portugal. A good chunk of their wine trade is actually with Britain. And he also issues some demands on arresting British expats and so on.
I think you're being too kind. Portugal has got a military and trading alliance with Britain that goes back to the 1400s. So this isn't like, oh, we quite like you at the minute. This is an old document. I believe the oldest standing military and trade agreement in the world as a legal document. And two, yeah, he says close the ports. And then what does he say after that? I actually want you to declare war on Britain, a nation that you quite like and get on very well with. I want you just to, out of the blue, declare war on Britain. And under severe pressure, Portugal do it. And they even act upon, they try to impound a few Royal Navy vessels in Lisbon and then get blockaded by the Royal Navy in return.
And it never works well, turning on the Royal Navy, does it?
It doesn't really work well. But it's not very active or very hard. The Royal Navy actually sent people into Lisbon to start a secret negotiation straight away. But even after the Portuguese government comply with every single request, still get invaded.
They do. And the Portuguese army isn't particularly... You've got to bear in mind that the French army is very well trained. Yes, it's a conscript force, but it gets honed. It's very hyped on the success of Napoleon's string of victories. It is the leading army in Europe. So the idea that the Portuguese army is going to be able to withstand the might of the French imperial army is just ridiculous.
There's like parallels with Germany going into Belgium in World War One, isn't there? Yeah. They can't defend themselves. There's not really an excuse for going in, but you're going to do it anyway.
Exactly.
The Portuguese know they're going to lose, and they don't actually put up any resistance. They don't actually fire a shot to defend Lisbon.
Like Luxembourg?
Yeah, more like Luxembourg.
With their 600 troops.
They know that the Portuguese army is okay, but they just know that they're just not going to win this. The one city that the civil powers there lock the gates for a couple of days, but no shots are fired. And still, the week after Lisbon is taken, the French start executing Portuguese loyalists in the streets.
The one great thing that the Portuguese do is they manage to evacuate their treasure fleet. So there's this big rush to get to Lisbon to capture the Portuguese treasury and just take the whole of it back to France and use it to fund France's wars. The Portuguese just managed to get it out in time.
It's like a Hollywood timing. You know, when James Bond cuts the wire and it's on 0.01, they're literally running down the streets of Lisbon as the gangplanks are coming up and they sail out the harbour.
They're sailing out the harbour as the French come into view of Lisbon. So they can physically see the Portuguese, excuse me. They can physically see the Portuguese sailing away with the treasure fleet. And the commanders must have known what was happening. Juno must have known and just thought, oh.
Murd, he would have probably said something to that effect.
He's here. But then we get to Spain.
Fine, French.
Now, Napoleon had obviously had to move his armies through Spain to get to the Portuguese border. Spain was actually allied to Napoleon at this point in time. And that's something that people often like to ignore. Now, there are some who like to turn around and say, but there were plans for the Spanish to attack the French. It's a bit like the suggestion that the Portuguese were going to withstand the might of the French armies. Nobody in their right mind thought that the Spanish armies, if they did invade southern France, were going to do anything useful or last or even succeed in any remote way.
This is the big alliance. They fought against the British 2 years earlier in Trafalgar.
Exactly. What Napoleon does is moves more and more French troops across Spain to the Portuguese border, but also ends up conveniently starting to just leave bodies of troops at key points in Spain, ostensibly to kind of more easily facilitate the supply of reinforcements and musketry, ammunition, and so on. What he then starts to do is just get a little bit bored and think, right, so who do I pick on next? So dumbing it down slightly. But nobody can quite work out why he felt the need to seize the Spanish throne. Some people talk about the navy and whether or not he was thinking about kind of taking the Spanish navy and using it in kind of morphing it into the French navy and using it that way. Some people question whether he was planning an invasion of North Africa off the back of success in Spain. It's just not clear what the plan was. But what he basically does is kidnap the Spanish monarchy. There's a dispute going on between the king and his son, Ferdinand VII. And he basically summons both of them to Fontainebleau and says, right, what you're going to do, you're both under house arrest. You're going to sign this document revoking your claim to the Spanish throne. And what he then does is this classic Napoleon thing of cronyism, where he gives the Spanish throne to his brother, Joseph.
Something we haven't touched on yet is the fact that he gives all of he's meant to be this famous revolutionary. He gives all of his best friends like ducal titles, princes and counts, and he gives thrones of Europe to his, I always find the term, feckless family.
They so we're rolling into Trump now, aren't we?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've got the son-in-law. Actually, we do have the son-in-law. We've got generalships going to Josephine's children, so his stepchildren. He's giving thrones to his sisters, now to his brothers. One of them's the king of Holland, and he disagrees with him because he wants just a puppetry king. He gives all of Spain to Joseph, the older brother, who is pretty useless.
He keeps moving his brothers around at different points in time.
And then he marries his sisters to his best friends and gives them thrones and palaces and loot and treasure. Yeah. Oh, and then obviously when we go back to Spain, the Spanish people get quite upset with this and they start a protest.
Funny that, really, isn't it? Yeah. You know, they object to having their monarch decided for them.
And there's a bit of a trigger where, so their king and their crown prince is under house arrest, and Napoleon orders now the princesses and the children to be taken to France. So they protest in Madrid.
The Dos Mayo uprising.
Yeah, Napoleon orders them all to be shot. And it's called.
I'm not sure it's Napoleon in person who.
Well, not Napoleon in person. I think we're going more down Joseph here now.
Effectively.
If we're going to be fair, we've got another Bonaparte. They start a huge massacre, which turns into the start of a civil war. To be fair to the Spanish army, who were allied to these people like yesterday, they start coming into the city, breaking open the armories, and defending those armories. And today, those generals, or actually, they're more like, actually, I think they're majors, a bit more junior. These majors break open the armories and they start arming the citizenry, but also their soldiers. And they very proudly start they know as the Spanish War of Independence from the foreign oppressors, as they kind of, I think, rightly see it.
So we know that Sean Bean comes in and that doesn't end well for Napoleon. But how do we get, why is Russia then involved?
Oh, so whilst Portugal goes to Britain and brings over Sean Bean, the Duke of Wellington, and a lot of other people.
Napoleon, and Jason Southey, let's not lose Jason
Southey. Southey, our friend Hugh Fraser as the Duke of Wellington, and David Troughton as the Duke of Wellington, Major Hogan, and Major Hogan, remember, he's now talking to Teresa, our friend, the Needle.
Bernard Cornwell does very well, writing the newspapers as well.
And and so that starts the Major Hogan's talking to the guerrillas, who are the Spanish people who are fighting for independence. And that's all going on in Spain and Portugal. Mm. That's like Zach and my like area of passion. So that's a whole other thing.
Napoleon, we will do a whole podcast on that. But why is the idiot trying to invade Russia?
Oh, because Spain's like so complicated that it's just left and done with, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, he spends a little bit of time in Spain, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
The early phase of the Peninsula War is really, really interesting. Spain turns around to its arch enemy, Britain, and says, help, basically, anything you like, any money, any guns. They don't actually want troops initially, but the British being the British, they have a force on standby that's about to go and invade British colonies in South America and suddenly diverts that force, which is under our...
Yeah, they're in Cork, and the Duke of Wellington gets given command. Well, he's Lord Wellesley, then. He gets given command.
Arthur Wellesley at that point, but later becomes Wellington. He's sent to the region, goes to Portugal, and then spends the next 6 years fighting his way backwards and forwards across Spain, trying to kick the French out. Napoleon's only there for a brief window in 1808 to very, very early 1809.
Just misses Wellesley Wellington. Just misses him. Fights against Sir John Moore.
Yes. When the Spanish have this really astonishing victory at a battle called Bailen, where they utterly humiliate a French force, and nobody knows where the hell this victory comes from. I speak to Spanish scholars who kind of say, you know, it was like a dream. Nobody can really kind of account for it, because on paper, the disparity in terms of quality is just huge. But that kind of acts as a galvanizing event for Napoleon. The French armies are pulled back behind the River Ebro. He goes to Spain, launches a very quick kind of classic hit them everywhere, hit them hard, Napoleon-style campaign, and effectively manages to reoccupy the bulk of Spain, even though large sections of the country are still in, the countryside is still in revolt. He then goes back to Paris, leaves his local generals and commanders and Joseph to try and manage the situation in Spain, thinking it'll just be a quick mopping up operation. that doesn't happen. But that's, as we say, a story for another podcast.
Yeah, he does kind of get out of there before the campaign's done. He's running back. He uses an excuse that there's like a coup or some political wranglings in France. And he leaves the battle against, he's now going against the British, actually, Sir John Moore. And he leaves it before it's complete, which does allow most of the British army to extract itself in a very Dunkirk style onto their ships.
Well, it's a campaign, but yeah, he sends part of his force to chase the British towards a place called Coruña.
Long retreats through like January snows, and they get onto these boats, 112 boats and ships, and most of them go back to Britain and then instantly back to Portugal. Meanwhile, he's now preparing the Grande Armée.
Yeah, well, he gets distracted, doesn't he? Because he's focused on marriage. He doesn't have a male heir. So we're back to Henry VIII all over again.
Oh,
so yeah, he effectively dumps off Josephine, pays her quite richly for it.
She rejects a lot of these, by the way. He gives her loads of gifts. She accepts the palaces, but some of the gifts she outright rejects.
Including... So she's got standards. Good for her.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So if you haven't had time to admire it, the Egyptian service that she's given is actually at Apsley House. And she rejects it, saying, I prefer to stay married to him. She throws a huge tantrum. Because he's going, if you can't give me a son, you're no use to me. Henry VIII again.
And so what he does is he tries to give himself another air of legitimacy, because he's always got this hang-up about whether or not he's properly part of the European kind of ruling classes. And the bottom line is that he isn't. He comes from minor nobility in a little island in the Mediterranean. And it's that complex again, that chip on his shoulder. So what he decides to do is to marry an Austrian princess, which is part of a peace treaty that he is able to conclude with the Austrians. So he's busy kind of getting married, securing a line of succession.
Very strange that she's Austrian. It's got huge hints of Marie Antoinette all over it, which was a bit of a trigger of the French Revolution.
The other thing about that period when he's busy trying to have a son is he loses his edge, which is what ultimately leads to the issues in the Russian campaign. And the Russians, although they secure they sign the Treaty of Tilsit in 1807, they get a bit bored with this whole continental system, and they start...
Sign it with a kiss on the lips, by the way, the Emperor of Russia.
Was it a kiss on the lips? I didn't know...
Because
Napoleon was very convinced that he'd done a good job of flattering the Russian Tsar. There seems to be a bit of a bromance.
So they actually build a barge... And they sign the treaty on a barge floating in the middle of like a river. So I kind of like ceremonially meet the two nations together. And in a traditional sense, the emperor and the Tsar seal the treaty with a kiss on the lips.
There are some very odd paintings, little miniatures of the Tsar and Napoleon. And, you know, they're sort of a little bit too close for just a kind of standard, you know, diplomatic discussion. It's sort of, I think I've seen Saki comments on Twitter about there must have been a bum pinch going on there.
I think there's a little grope. And is this when he goes on his rabbit hunt?
Oh, I can't remember when the rabbit hunt is.
I think this is Alex one we didn't mention we're going to bring up, but I really want to bring up.
Just bring it up anyway.
Basically, I think around after the Treaty of Tilsit, Napoleon celebrates. What he's going to do is go on a grand hunt. But what they're going to do is they're going to capture, they order a load of like rabbits, like local, you know, fluffy bunnies to be caged and then released in front of them. And they're just going to shoot them with muskets. And
why would you do that to bunnies? Of all the things we've done, massacres in Egypt, plague, abandoning your armies. Now I'm really fucking pissed off.
And now he's going to cross
the line. Now
he's
going to
shoot bunnies for no reason.
He's going to shoot bunnies, but this is where it gets good. The bunnies
Tell me
are hungry.
The bunnies attack them.
The bunnies attack him.
Oh, brilliant.
They turn around. Possibly they think because his uniform is green, it might be food or something. There's some general confusion. And the rabbits turn around and jump on Napoleon. And he has to like run away from the rabbits. It's like Monty Python. They're not killer rabbits. They're genuinely fluffy local little rabbits. And they are chasing away the emperor.
I love it. Not only has he failed to invade Russia, but he's failed to take out the bunnies as well. What a knob.
I'm seeing it far more as like Peter Rabbit.
I want them to be innocent little bunnies. I don't want them armed or in uniform or anything. I just want like people's pet rabbits gnawing on him. Anyway.
That has got to go into the cartoon.
Yes, there are going to be bunnies all over Napoleon lying at our feet on the cartoon. Oh, Bertie just raised his head into the zoom shot.
So he invades Russia. Like to summarise, it's like the biggest army that Europe's pretty much seen in this era. He goes in, like no provision set for this era. It takes far too long using narrow roads. And when he arrives, there's one major battle of this campaign called Borodino. And this is where Napoleon should be in his element. He's got like the biggest army he's pretty much ever commanded. He's bringing all these elements together, and it's against a huge Russian army that actually builds some fortifications on some heights. And his generals are at their prowess. Let's be fair to them, definitely. Meanwhile, I want to say 2 miles away, but it could be a bit less. Napoleon sulks. He sits down and he's like, don't give a stuff. His generals go in and do a hell of a lot of work on Borodino and flanking manoeuvres. They ask if they can do really extravagant flanking manoeuvres. They have need his permission for this, and he denies it, and he keeps going, just go straight in. You can brush it away. Charge up the middle. Huge casualties. They're kind of winning, and then they turn around to Napoleon and say, look, the only reinforcements we've got are the Imperial Guard. The French Imperial Guard, who are the elite of the elites. They've all got 4 years service, extra pay, better uniforms. And Napoleon just refuses. He likes to hold them back. He likes to basically have them as like a palace guard near him. Or send them out where the victory is assured and sweep away. So they're going to win. They're going to win victory. And he sulks. He says, no, they're the only soldiers I've got left. You can't have them. They're mine. So I always think that Borodino is won despite Napoleon.
I always think of Borodino more as kind of one of these World War One style precursor battles of attrition, in the sense that yes, they do succeed, but it's a battle that's won through blood essentially, and just wearing the Russians down. The whole campaign is just poorly handled. Part of the issue, some say, is that the army was just too big. It was 500,000 men, and you can't really maneuver an army of that size in any effective kind of way. I also think that Napoleon thinks that he can just kind of fight the battles that he's always fought, sweep in, one crushing victory, force the Russians to negotiate peace terms. The Russians don't play that game. They just keep retreating, keep withdrawing, keep sucking Napoleon into the heart of Russia. And I mean, Alex, you recently did that thing for War Factories, didn't you, where you made the point that when it came to the Nazi invasion of Russia in 1941, nobody had read a history book. And there's this great shot of you just kind of sadly shaking your head saying nobody had heard of Napoleon.
Yeah,
nobody
sounds like something book. I'd say.
So I don't blame him for getting sucked in, because there is no precursor to this. But he gets too carried away. There's one point where he has the opportunity to just kind of stop and winter. And he decides, no, I'm going to keep pushing on. Ends up being drawn all the way to Moscow. In this awesome kind of scorched earth policy, they even end up burning down Moscow. And Napoleon walks into Moscow, finds it basically burning to the ground around him, and realizes that he can't stay for the winter in Moscow. He's got no choice but to pull back. And so they have to run effectively for Poland through a Russian winter, which, as you can imagine, I mean, these people are in woolen clothes. It was the wrong clothing for the summer, when it was impossibly hot. During the winter, loads of men freeze to death. They're harried the whole way by the Cossacks. It's of the 500,000 who go in, it's thought that 10% survive. So 50,000 make it out.
Oh, that's and just then criminally negligent, isn't it?
And it gets worse. Halfway back, Napoleon jumps in a sleigh, a horse-drawn sleigh, and I think the technical term is buggers off back to Paris.
Is that the one where it's alleged that he dressed as a woman as a disguise?
There is that alleged. There's another story, which is that he tries to come to a river crossing with a ferry, and he asks the ferryman if he's seen anyone come this way, and he goes, no, I saw 500,000 men go one way and only one man come back. I think the woman one might be a step too far, but it's certainly the fact that something we did touch on with Spain, when he's, his army's massacring people, and it's one of my hot topics is that his armies are encouraged to steal loot. Not food for themselves, loot for Napoleon's parents. And in doing so, especially in Spain, rape and murder is used as a weapon. And I've got first-hand accounts from the French officers that they've been ordered to do this. Desecrate churches, rape and kill women. It's disgusting. They do it in France as well. Sorry, they do it in Russia as well. They do it in Russia quite widely because the army is so big. They've got to steal from every peasant they come across. They're going to burn down the farm and take it if it hasn't had scorched earth. That means that when the Cossacks, the Russian cavalry corps, are like chasing them, that's not the end of their problems. Every time they come to a village, these like dejected men now, some of them are still carrying silverware, like they're trying to get back to France with a bit of loot. But they're starting to like disregard their own weapons if they can and things like this. They're coming to a village and you're going to get some like old Russian lady come out with a kitchen knife. Is like seeing her daughter raped, her granddaughter killed, and she's going to be stabbing and cutting this soldier's throat. And there are cases where these soldiers are like sitting down, freezing to death by a tree, and the Russian peasants, especially the Russian peasant women, are coming out. They're killing them. There's no mercy.
Reprisal killings are not unusual in Spain and Portugal, and as you say, in Russia, because, I mean, initially the French policy is we live off the land. But the trouble is, once you're letting your soldiers take whatever they want in terms of food, it becomes very difficult to pick out that dividing line between taking food and just taking whatever the hell else you want. The French also have this kind of way of characterizing martial masculinity, which includes sexual dominance over men and women. But obviously, particularly during this period, taking a kind of rape of women, having that kind of edge to it. And yeah, it's unsurprising really that this is why the wars become so bitter in Russia and in Spain and Portugal, because you've got civilians who just take matters into their own hands and exact their revenge.
One of the quotes I've got for Spain is this, I think actually it was a cousin of Josephine. And he writes that we gave the village the choice, their women or their church. The village chose to save the church rather than the women. But in the end, we desecrated both. These are just disgusting like acts. And they are acts that are being planned out by both the junior and the senior commanders. And it's why I, like in reading so, flipped on an edge and became very much more anti-Napoleon.
And I think this is why Marcus and I have such an issue, not with, I mean, I can only speak for myself. I don't want to put words in your mouth here, Marcus, but from my perspective, I can understand somebody admiring Napoleon. I can get my head around people liking Napoleon even, because the point has been made by more eloquent people than me that quite often if you like authoritarian style governments, like strong military commanders, you're going to like Napoleon. That's kind of the way that your mind works, and he fits very neatly into that. And that's fine.
It's the cult, isn't it, that really pisses you off?
It's the cult following, yeah. The people who will not acknowledge any failing, will not acknowledge any of the bad. And if you raise any of these things, they turn around and go, yeah, but what about the British Empire? Which is a legitimate point. And at no point will you find myself, and I think this is also true of Marcus, saying that the British Empire was this wonderful entity that ever did any wrong. But the point is that we
if you dislike empire and empire building and you think the empire did a bad thing, you're going to think that Napoleon's empire did a bad thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And people think the British Empire did loads of bad things as well.
Yeah. They turn around and say, well, Britain's colonial empire, that's different. Well, no, it's not. These are both empires that are militarily enforced on people who have no interest in them. Yes, there's a racial element to the British Empire. Of course there is. But, and in fairness to Napoleon, when he's in Egypt particularly, there's no evidence of prejudice towards the local population there. When he massacres people, he tends to massacre people kind of
indiscriminately.
Yeah, you know, yeah. But there's no race.
Everyone's fair in front of the bayonet. I think that's a good policy, isn't it?
Well, let's talk about his failings and really wind the lunatics up then, because peace terms are enforced upon him, and even then, you have issues with how this plays out, don't you? And the priorities that he enforces when he's, because he refuses to accept the terms, doesn't he, at a cost to his men?
Yeah, that's it. By this point, he's retreated from Russia. So all of Europe mobilizes against him. This is a trigger point. Spain's been going on as a like ulcer. Russia is the catalyst, and his retreat from there, the loss of the Grand Army, everyone. So Prussia has to switch sides and back, Austria, but even Sweden. Sweden's been governed by King Bernadotte, who's actually one of Napoleon's former marshals, and even he's had enough. There's a lot of reasons, but Sweden declares war on France, and it's really the beginning of the end. It's inevitable when, and I don't mean an exaggeration, nearly every like empire, great kingdom, and some of the smaller like duchies and princedoms are fighting against Napoleon now. He's going to lose. He goes on and actually fights a really impressive campaign, but he's given the chance to end it and keep his borders.
Twice he's given the chance. So that you've got two...
And he rejects it. And what does he say when he rejects it?
That he thinks he can win. That he thinks he can go ahead and secure a victory through the blood of, effectively, his own soldiers. There is a point...
He can sacrifice his own men for his like reign to continue.
Yeah, because there are two negotiations that centre around 1813, 1814. There's this big battle called Leipzig, sometimes known as the Battle of the Nations. It's the biggest battle that has ever been fought up until that point in history.
It's huge. I mean, you've even got Saxony in the middle of it, actually changing sides. You've got Bernadotte, the marshal, he's coming in and he's got a bit of a quarrel with one of his former comrades. So there's a bit of a personal battle going on between a French general and a Spanish king. It is just enormous.
One of you is going to want a quote, aren't they, on these peace negotiations?
I think Zach's got something good.
Well, I mean, this one isn't particularly about the peace negotiations per se. It just kind of captures that sense of Napoleon not really giving a monkey's about the human cost of his conflict. So there's a point where he is reviewing the carnage of a battle and he turns around and says, and I'm quoting here, one Paris night will replace them all. Une nuit de Paris remplacera cela. Now, excuse the French accent because, as we've established, my accents are apocalyptically bad. But
I don't know, I quite liked your American accent.
Really?
American you did? That was hilarious.
Yeah. Didn't attempt dealing with the Irish. But anyway, let's get back to Napoleon. There's another one, actually, where he says that he thinks nothing of losing 10,000 men if it realises his objective.
That's in these peace treaties. 10,000 men.
It's just, it captures the breathtaking arrogance of this man, that his personal ambitions, which is what we're talking about here, we're talking about his empire, his personal glory comes before what's the good for the French nation. These are French citizens by this point who have to be drawn into this fight, because for a good chunk of this, part of how France fights its wars is to recruit soldiers from other nations as a kind of an enforced levy. And that's what a large chunk of the army that goes into Russia is made up of, particularly Polish troops. By 1813, a lot of it has to come from France, and particularly 1814. And he does fight these incredible campaigns. 1814 is just mind-blowing. It's a parallel, really, of what he does in his early days in Italy.
I think the Duke of Wellington reads about it and goes like, my God, that's generalship. Like, that is impressive.
It's an incredible campaign because he's got this smaller army that he can pivot and move much faster. So it suits his way of making war. But there's a second time where he's offered worse peace terms by this point, because the coalition is now on the borders of France. You've got Wellington having invaded southern France, being the first country to get its troops onto French soil since the early days of the Revolutionary Wars back in the early 1790s. And still, he's determined to fight on, thinking that he can win one big battle and change everything. And that's before we even get to Waterloo, which is just another story in itself in terms of breathtaking arrogance.
But before that, he ends up on Elba, arguably where he belongs after causing so much trouble, like a naughty child.
Well, you'd say he belongs in Elba, but the British government think it's a bit close and maybe we should be sending him somewhere a bit further away.
Like the Falkland Islands, maybe.
Somewhere St. Helena, a barren rock in the middle of the Atlantic. He goes to Elba. And what's quite interesting is for just a really short amount of time, and like most of his family deserted, bar one sister, most of his generals swear allegiance to Louis XVIII. It's really like obese, useless monarch. And he's abandoned. But he does, for a short time, he shows some of his old spark. I think it's like that kind of, it was all getting too big, it's all too overwhelming, and he tries to reform it. Well, I say that. He does actually try to kill himself. He's got a vial of poison around his neck from his time in Russia, and he tries to take it and end it all, and he's just violently sick instead of dying. I think it makes him quite ill from both ends.
It's gone off. He's had it for too long. Does it actually predate Russia? I've got a feeling he's been carrying it around for years.
Yeah, even longer.
And somehow Russia. Thinks, I might be wrong. So if somebody...
You've got to question the psychology of someone, someone who's commanding like one of the greatest and largest armies in, well, let's say the European world, carrying around a poison of a vial of poison to kill themselves. It's quite interesting.
I mean, there's always that chance that you can be captured. Given the mentality of Napoleon during the during the Russian campaign, he wasn't going to be kind of leading the front. But in terms of his earlier ways of being right in the thick of things, perhaps there was a chance that he could have been captured. But yeah, so he ends up on Elba. Initially, as you say, he does this great job of trying to reorganize so many different aspects.
They've universities, roads, hospitals.
Yeah. And then he gets bored. Classic Napoleon. Just gets bored.
About 6 months, well bored.
Yeah. And starts to look at returning to France and sees, I mean, we talked about this in a podcast before, so we won't go into loads of depth on the Waterloo campaign and its origins, but he sees the coalition powers squabbling amongst themselves about how they're going to carve up Europe in the wake of his fall, and sees an opportunity to come back, restore himself as emperor, and sweep all before him somehow. And it doesn't work out like that at all, because the one thing that unified all these people was Napoleon. As soon as he became a threat again,
How does he get away from Elba?
That's quite funny. He does like always back for one last job. Hollywood classic. He draws.
It's as tiresome as like Rambo 6, isn't it?
Yeah, like, we're like Rambo 7.5 almost. Everyone's like, oh, not another war. we give him a small army on Elba, like some of his Imperial Guard.
Are we idiots?
It's only 1,000 men.
It's only 1,000 men, 2 cannon, like 80 horses, and 2 ships. And what he does is he paints these ships to look British rather than French. And then you got to give it like some like thingish cone of shame to this guy. The governor of the island goes off to see his girlfriend, his mistress, in Italy. And he thinks, oh, you know what, it's only been like 8 months. Napoleon's really resigned himself to, you know, being the emperor of this tiny island. He's never going to escape, even though it's only a few miles off the coast of France, really. And he goes off, kind of makes Napoleon promise he won't be a bad boy, and turns it back and goes and sees his girlfriend. Napoleon draws in his small army and gets onto these ships that he's managed to hide in a bay. I don't know how he's managed to really hide them, paint them, bring them ashore. And off he slips. He actually sails past a royalist French vessel. And there's a lot of debate whether they see it and turn a blind eye to it, see it, ignore it, or see it and actually go, yay, Napoleon's back. And it prevents another war in Europe, because at this point you've got a lot of debate over like places like Alsace-Lorraine, Poland especially is a hot topic, and you're about to have like Austria, Germany, Russia, and Russia go to war with each other over these nations. But lo and behold, they all suddenly see their old enemy come back, and they all pretty much like put their port down, draw their swords and go, right, another one. And hence we get Waterloo.
Which obviously we have covered in great detail elsewhere. It doesn't end well for him. If you want to go back and hear a great summary of the Battle of Waterloo with these two, it is out there on our back catalogue. So he loses.
He sleeps through quite a bit of the battle. He's suffering from hemorrhoids and piles.
There's the piles, isn't there?
Can we go back to our mental Facebook guy now? Because this is...
Oh.
Yeah.
There's no evidence of piles because there's no paintings of piles.
But it was worse than that. So Marcus and I were recently on... there are a number of Facebook groups out there to do with the Napoleonic Wars.
This is one of the big ones. This is like the official association.
This was the Waterloo Association, which I have to say is very well managed by a guy called Gareth Glover. And as soon as I made him aware of what was happening, he dealt with it straight away. But this guy was, he posted a picture of Napoleon sleeping through the Battle of Borodino, which we've discussed already, not being one of Napoleon's great moments, okay? And he captioned it, "The Great Man Sleeping at Waterloo." Now, I can't remember if Marcus got to this first or I did. I've got a feeling it might have been Marcus. And he turned
around. Were you both like, "Hold my drink. Somebody hold my earrings. I'm going in."
We're also doing the "Bring in the cavalry." Zach!
And I think you got to it first and turned around and said, "Look, mate, it's not Waterloo. It's Borodino. Here's the link to the original." And then I chipped in and said, "And with the best one in the world, it's documented that he probably wasn't sleeping through Waterloo. He was having some form of medical treatment, possibly for his piles." Now, this guy just turned around and said, "No, it's a lie." And so we started saying, "So, sorry, what bit's the lie? The fact that we can categorically prove this isn't from Borodino, or the fact that there are documented sources from Napoleon's medical team saying that he was treated for piles around the time of Waterloo?"
He said both, didn't he?
He turned around and said both.
Oh, so he just went full Mel Gibson crap.
Yeah, and his painting of like Napoleon sulking at Borodino is by a French artist. It's a lovely painting.
And when we kept pushing the point, because you know what I'm like with these things, I don't let them drop because I'm just pedantic like that. And he turned around and went, "Yeah, but look at the painting. Do you see Napoleon being treated for piles in this painting? I don't think so." And I just couldn't get my head around the psychology of this guy.
Who'd paint a fucking picture of someone shitting out veins?
So Zach and I now want to do a GoFundMe page to get a painting of Napoleon having piles treated. Don't you think
we probably, our graphic artist that's working on Great War Group for a laugh, would be willing to take on a commission to do like a digital image of Napoleon's piles?
That's all
for the guy.
Need.
Yeah.
I just couldn't get my head around it.
But we did spend a lot of time looking at the history of hemorrhoid treatment. It was not a good day.
Let's go around the other side of his anatomy. I love this. There's a documented source of a lady who was banged by both Napoleon and Wellington. And what did she say?
So this is Madame George. There's two ladies that we think have been banged by both, if we're going to use that term.
Okay.
The lady in the room used that term. And there's Madame Grassini.
It was either Giuseppe banging or Grassini. Boffing, and I went for...
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And Grassini is a famous opera singer, and she slept with both of them. And then there's Madame George, who was like a minor actress. And she sleeps with both and writes that Wellington was more vigorous in bed, which kind of... You know, as they say in Carry On, up the Khyber, keeping the British end up.
Yeah, Marcus is like, vindicated. Everything I've said about Napoleon is vindicated.
There's my boy.
We started talking about his penis for a reason, haven't we? Well, let's kill him off first, and then we'll get to Penisgate. What? How does Napoleon meet his end?
Can I kill him off and Zachary penis, I think? I want to kill Napoleon and Zachary likes talking about his penis. It's just got a lot of personalities.
Now Zach's doing the hand. Right, okay.
So yeah, Waterloo, greatest story ever told, not Wellington's best battle, and do go listen to the podcast and some of the other stuff we've done. Podcast's quite fun. And Waterloo, he runs away, funny this is getting a theme. He tries to fight in Paris. The French government say they have enough of it. There's a few little skirmishes, but he then runs away and surrenders on a little British ship called the Billy Ruffian to its mates, the HMS Bellerophon. He's almost taken to Plymouth. He's not quite. He's then taken to the British island of St. Helena, which is, if you put a pin in the middle of the South Atlantic, it's there.
Which is where we should have sent him in the first place, right?
Right, exactly.
With no army.
I mean, you're talking thousands of miles to either Africa or like Central America.
Yeah, no army. No boat. And no, who gave him the paint? Gave him the right colour paint?
He's got a kingdom in Elba. In St. Helena, he's actually got a courtyard.
Just a guy on a rock.
He's in a rock, and it's got guard towers. The British actually put a regiment there to guard.
And they're not his regiment.
Not his regiment. Right. British soldiers. He's allowed to take a couple of generals who want to go with him. There's a few. There's like some French doctors, but even they get bored in the end and come back. And he's actually looked after by British doctors. Dr. Arnott, I actually know one of his descendants. So he's on this little island. There are a couple of plans, especially from the French who fled to America, to maybe go and rescue him. But luckily, it never happened, because even if he went to...
theorists probably say that he escaped to Argentina, but you know, that's
could have gone to Argentina.
Was he drinking wine and eating steak with Hitler somewhere?
Probably.
Probably still today, probably going to be frozen. There's like a Ian Holm film, who plays Bilbo Baggins in The Hobbit, where they do a Prince of the Pauper and switch and he goes to Paris, but that's all Prince of the Pauper fantasy. So he doesn't live there very long. He dies there, only 5 years later, 6 years later.
He dies from stomach cancer. Well, he's got severe stomach cancer. It's actually a tear in his esophagus that actually brings about the end for him. He has quite an unpleasant last few years of his life.
He's in pain.
He's in a lot of pain. There's a lot of antagonism between him and the governor of St. Helena. And from a lot of the accounts, it seems that the governor makes life pretty hard for Napoleon in his final days.
But we don't give him someone who's going to go off and look after his girlfriend. We actually give him like almost like a jailer.
Yeah. And he spends a lot of the time creating the Napoleonic legend. So a lot of the big myths that we have, like some of the big speeches, for example, from the start of the Italian campaign, where he's supposed to have turned around to his soldiers and said, soldiers, you are starving, you are clothed in rags. Actually, it was written on St. Helena, never came from the Italian campaign. So he uses the time to build this myth. And that's probably why the cult of Napoleon is as strong as it is, because he's one of the few dictators in European history who's had the chance to write his own history before he died, but after he fell from power.
He's like officially an ex-dictator. And what I quite like about the governor of St. Helena is he doesn't even allow him to be called the emperor. Because legally he's not, because there's a king of France. They allowed him to be the emperor of Elba. So if you want to go and have anything from Bonaparte, you've got to address him as General Bonaparte. And even that's being quite respectful, because he's not even a general in the French army anymore. And Bonaparte hates this. He only wants to be called Your Majesty. He gets really stressy about it.
And can we just clear up another conspiracy theory, which is that the British allegedly poisoned him, which isn't true. They did find traces of arsenic in his hair, but that's because they're using paint that's laced with arsenic from the production methods at the time. So there was no concerted effort to poison Napoleon. And then we get to the issue of his penis.
This is a History Hack favourite topic. It keeps coming up. Anyway, right.
So the story goes that during Napoleon's autopsy, the doctor presiding over it chopped off Napoleon's gentleman region, had it pickled, and it made its way to America eventually, where it was found and carbon dated and proved to be from the 19th century.
So I've heard that they keep coming up on eBay and up for auction, and that the French government buy them every time, and that they've got roughly a dozen Napoleon cocks in their collection.
Yeah, someone sold just a foreskin recently, a couple of years ago. Someone asked, why didn't we buy it for our collection?
Just go back to the point where the doctor went, oh, I fancy a souvenir. I'd take his little finger if you're a weirdo like that.
You know, people like take a little lock of hair? Yeah. A lock of hair. And they did a death mask. You know, that's kind of normal for the era. We've got some lots of hair.
Well, that's dangling off. I'll remove that.
What the fuck?
What is quite telling about all of this is that whenever one of these comes onto the market, it's always really very small. There was a Channel 4 documentary in 2014 that claimed to have found the original Napoleon penis. And apparently it measured at 1.5 inches. And I think what's quite telling is that this fits into how the British like to think about Napoleon.
Because that's not a penis, that's a chode, isn't it? Is that what it's called when it's under 2 inches? There's a name, isn't there, for when... No, I think it's when... Because I've called people this before on social media. The width is wider than the length. It's called
that's
a chode.
That's what I remember from my teenage years, yeah.
Yeah,
I'm just going to say I don't have any experience of that. Just leave it there.
You lie.
Whereas Alex is like, I know all the technical terms for tiny penis.
Man, I have got every so word you could possibly use to insult conspiracy theories on Twitter. I have used it, and I have definitely used that. Anyway,
I mean, smaller than a fluffy rabbit. There we go.
Yeah, a fluffy rabbit that's going to attack Napoleon. I love that. That's definitely going to be the cartoon for this.
The issue I have with the whole it's Napoleon's penis thing is firstly that there are so many of them. There are precedents for this kind of thing. Allegedly, you can, I mean, if you depend on what you like going into your Google search history, but you can Google Rasputin's penis and it's apparently quite an impressive specimen. As I say, the Napoleon ones always seem to not be. But
they look like a little grape shriveled up, don't they? It's the best way to describe it. Because, of course, I've Googled this. You're all going to go and Google it now and see if you can see what it looks like. But it looks like a little shriveled grape, doesn't it? Don't act like you two don't know. You're both laughing.
I genuinely have never Googled this. And this, I'm just like, oh, Zach is definitely be Googling this.
Well, your phone is in your hand, Marcus. So Zach's just a mess.
It's the screensaver on Zach's PC, I thought.
No, they do. It just looks like a raisin's a bit cruel, a grape.
The issue I have is the kind of, partly like you said, Alex, the psychology of it. If you're going to take something, why do you take that? But also the kind of, the international incident that would have surrounded demasculating France's national hero, because Napoleon was still popular within sections of French society. That's why he was able to come back in 1815. The army flocked to him. He, for them to take off that would require everybody to keep quiet. Now, the odds of that happening are slim to non-existent anyway. You've then got the fact that he was dug up and moved to the Hotel L'Invalide in the centre of Paris. And if you're ever in Paris, go to Napoleon's tomb, because it is the most incredible.
It is incredible, but it's like you do wonder if it's compensating for the fact that the corpse doesn't have a penis, because it is slightly elaborate, isn't it?
It's huge. I mean, when you compare it to where he was buried on St. Helena, which was in this beautiful little valley with flowers, and it was just like a little stone tomb, like it looked like in any British like churchyard, it's completely the other end, like marble domes. When I was there, they had a little display of his uniform and his hat, and you've got eagles.
Statues.
Yeah. Surrounded by angels.
The sarcophagus is larger than a two-bedroom flat in London.
There are seven of them, I think. They're a sarcophagus.
They layer inside, don't they? Like the Egyptians.
Yeah. But the point is, they exhumed him in order to take him back to Paris. And one of the things that people remark on is the fact that when they took him out, he was perfectly, and I mean perfectly, preserved. And lots of people tried to kind of create some kind of Saint Napoleon myth type
thing. King Arthur just sleeping stuff.
Exactly. And they'd have noticed, you know what I mean? They examined his body. Somebody would have noticed and gone, this is outrageous. And the idea that the French would have just gone, yeah, fine, chop off his chap. And
the kind of thing a Frenchman would notice as well. Not to say that the French are preoccupied with peni, but they do quite like virility and culturally, don't they? And they're quite, I think it's the most offensive thing. I think if you asked a Frenchman if he's both hands or his penis, he'd choose to lose his hands. Just saying, I have a French ex-boyfriend, so I've just alienated the whole of France for this podcast. Yeah. I think we've probably done that at some point anyway with all of the Napoleon bashing we do on here. Guys, let's finish off. This has been brilliant. It's turned into a proper extended special, and I'm not going to cut it at all. I want to know, what's your favourite portrayal of Napoleon? I'll lay it out there. Mine is Bill and Ted, where he's like doing the 32 scoops of ice cream and playing the fucking.
But he goes to Waterloo, doesn't he? It's a water.
Yeah. And he's at the water park. I love, love, love that portrayal of Napoleon. And I have a feeling, is that not the same actor who played the really camp, over-the-top villain in one of the Hornblowers?
Oh, is it, yeah, it might be. Robin Cook? Think,
I'm not sure. Maybe.
Robin Cook.
Maybe they just merged into one person in my brain. But guys, what's your favourite portrayal of Napoleon?
On film, mm-hmm. I mean, the classic is Rod Steiger, because I think he fits the image of Napoleon at that point in time really well. Some of the overacting is just hilarious. I mean, I love that moment of la gare recule, and for no obvious reason, Napoleon goes, I need to check what the weather's doing, and looks up into the air at the camera that's suspended 7 feet above.
If you're one of the actors, though, there's arguably no way you can overact Napoleon, is there?
I think pretty much everything. Yeah. In terms of visual depiction, I love the Gilray caricature, the plum pudding in danger, which is of, people will Google this. You've got this tiny little Napoleon carving off a little slice of a plum pudding that's labelled Europe, whilst you've got the British Prime Minister at the time just chopping through half of the globe and occupying that. It's kind of making this lovely statement about how Napoleon, this little person involved with little aims of trying to take over Europe, whilst Britain's seeing the bigger picture and is just taking half the globe for itself. And I think that really encapsulates a lot of the
cartoons at the time, which is fantastic.
Mm. Yeah.
I think people really go on about, don't you realise about the British Empire? It's like, we knew then, we were doing it. Yeah, for me, I mean, Rod Steiger in Waterloo, filmed in 1970, just fantastic. What a great film. Christopher Plummer's Waterloo. As Wellington, just brilliant. But, I mean, Napoleon and Blackadder back and forth, pretty funny. I mean, they're all like prancing around with handkerchiefs, and it's deeply, deeply offensive if you're French or, I guess, Corsican. But it's very funny. I quite like it. They say that we're going to war because of like the insults that we make over France, and it's only a little bit off the truth.
Brilliant. Some of the Horrible Histories ones are great as well. Where they kind of capture some of the petulance that comes through in some of the real quotes.
Yeah, and they do Napoleon with an Italian accent as well.
Guys, thank you so much. This has been epic. I feel like we have really given everybody an overview of Napoleon, probably one that will make French people cry, but French people, just give us a call and we'll let you have your say.
Everything we've said, as far as we're aware, completely true, but completely biased.
Yes, but we said at the beginning that was going to be the case. To be fair, I think Zach has done a pretty good job of not making his career implode today.
Can we just point some people in the direction of some stuff if they want to actually go and fact check
of course.
Some of this? Because there are a few decent books. If you are a Napoleon lover, then your Bible is a book by Andrew Roberts called Napoleon the Great. Which tells you everything you need to know about Andrew, who is a nice enough individual.
Andrew, really nice man. Really, really good historian.
But you two hate this disagree. Book, don't
you? He's the opposite to us. He loves Napoleon.
Yeah, Philip Dwyer's done this brilliant three-volume biography of Napoleon. Yes, there's a lot of it, there's a lot to get through, but it's incredibly detailed. If you're looking for something a bit more popular, Owen Connolly did something called Blundering to Glory. He's very pro-Napoleon. Philip Dwyer is very anti-Napoleon. And Michael Brouwers is doing a series, Soldier of Destiny. So there's plenty out there. Bear in mind, though, that Napoleon's like historical Marmite. There's people love him or they hate him, and there's very little kind of middle ground. So vary your diet essentially of what you're reading.
If you only read one source of Napoleon, you are only going to get one side of the cookie, really.
Guys, thank you so much. This has been brilliant. Once again, you have been an awesome double act. I know we also do have in the bank a great interview with Zach on crime and punishment in the British Army at this time, which is his PhD, which is really interesting and really good and gives you a really good reality check about the British Army, which is quite possibly needed. Guys, you will be back down the pub. I think we're debating the greatest book in history, aren't we, next time?
We are. I'm going to see who I can steal from this steal time. I've got Lena's last time, James's the time before that. So
I might just select the best suggestion I get and pass it to you, and we'll just let you go first and then laugh. Deal?
I mean, it's obviously Horrible Histories anyway, so.
Yeah. Brilliant, guys. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Join us tomorrow when Josh Proven will be with us to talk all about the Hawaiian monarchy. He and I had an absolute blast recording this one, and there is a quite shameless appeal for a free trip to Hawaii for both of us if you care to listen all the way to the end, so don't miss that. And then in the evening, Owen Griffiths will be back to tell us why there is a dragon on the Welsh flag. He's got some more folklore for you, one of the big ones, one of the most famous, and he's going to share that for you for over the weekend. Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as a dollar a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.